It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Center Studios of Messiah College, the nexus of transatlantic currents in Grantham, Pennsylvania. This is the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast, a bi-weekly discussion dedicated to American history, historical thinking, and the role of history in our everyday lives. And now, here's your host, author and award-winning historian, John Fia.
Thank you, Drew, and welcome to episode 36 of the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast. Today's episode is focused on the 18th century Atlantic world. We are going to explore how human beings moved within this world and used such travel to shape their identities. In the last 30 years, the Atlantic world has dominated the study of early American history, especially British American history. As the historian Philippe Fernandez Armesto once put it, during this period, the traffic in goods, ideas, and people made it possible to think of a single civilization spanning the ocean. The culturally distant eastern seaboard colonies founded in the early and mid-17th century became increasingly more connected to Europe as time went on. My graduate school advisor, Ned Landsman, described the transition from colonials, that is, people living in remote outposts of the British Empire, to provincials, men and women fully integrated into the empire. By the eve of the American Revolution, the British North American colonies were serving the economic interests of the empire. They were awash in British consumer goods. They were exposed to British ideas about political liberty and Protestant religion like never before, through books and other forms of print. The Atlantic was shrinking, not literally, but figuratively and in an imagined sense. Of course, the Atlantic world was not just a British phenomenon. The Atlantic Ocean tied together the destinies of Africans, Latin Americans, and people living in other parts of Europe. A focus on the Atlantic world has challenged a view of history that we usually describe as Whig. This is an approach to American history that sees the story of the 13 colonies solely in terms of the coming of the American Revolution. Since the late 18th century, when the first American histories began to be written, Whig historians have dominated the field. The important actors in the stories they tell were those who had some impact on the coming of the new nation. Human beings living in North America are only important, according to the Whig historians, if their lives point in some way towards 1776 and the creation of a unique and, dare I say, exceptional American nation. Historians of the Atlantic world know better than to embrace such Whig pieties. They know that the colonies were born in a constant engagement with the larger world on the other side of the proverbial pond. In fact, one might even argue that American independence was impossible without these connections. America was born as part of an international community of people, people of all colors, people enslaved and free, and people who moved within this Atlantic community. Drew, you're a grad student in early American history. How does this idea of the Atlantic world shape your work?
Considering that Lehigh's history department has a sharp Atlantic focus, of course, this is a history department who's one of our most famous emeritus professors is Lawrence Henry Gibson, one of the founders of one of the first Atlantic challenges to this Whig narrative, the Imperial School of American History. So, yeah, the Atlantic paradigm has been a focus of my writing, my scholarship. my training, and now my teaching. Further, I'm an ethnohistorian, meaning I turn my focus towards the lives of colonized indigenous people within transatlantic imperial and colonial contexts.
So you just told me before the episode started, Drew, that you are 3 weeks away from your comprehensive exams.
I don't know if the mic is picking up the sound of my teeth chattering.
Exactly. So I assume you have a lot of books related to the Atlantic world on your comps list. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, I have three fields that are specifically Atlantic focused. So I'm French Atlantic, Spanish Atlantic, okay, and then colonial British Atlantic.
So I'm going to put you on the spot here, Drew, and give me some titles.
All right. Well, I'll try to make these good recommendations for everyone who wants to go pick one of these up.
Yeah, give us something. Don't give us the heavy monographs, the theoretical stuff. Give us something that our listeners might be able to pick up to learn something about the Atlantic world.
Well, one modern classic that anytime friends or family ask me, you know, oh, what's a good book for me to read? One that I always recommend is Daniel Richter's Facing East from Indian Country, which has really changed a lot of the ways many of us as historians even just linguistically frame our studies, right? This is the whole idea that we as historians shouldn't only be studying Indians from a European perspective, but also studying Europe from an Indian perspective.
Now, I can't remember. Colonial America was the one course you didn't take with me. Is that right?
That's correct.
It was like 15 years ago we're talking now. But I've been assigning Richter. It teaches very, very well. Some of you social studies teachers out there, it's a nice book to read. You're not going to assign it to your students, but it's a nice book to read to give you some perspective on this kind of Atlantic world the way Drew is describing it.
Another good one, especially for those who are interested in the history of Christianity, is Sylvia Fry and Betty Woods' Come Shouting to Zion. One of the neat things they do in this book is they're talking about the formation of that distinct African-American Christianity that emerges in the 19th century especially, but they're doing it in comparison with the American South and the Caribbean, right? Bringing those two regions into conversation and saying that you can't really understand African-American Christianity unless you're engaging with both. Oftentimes, for American historians, it's just a story of the American South.
I'm actually encouraged that you're reading that book because actually I read that book on my comps too. Yeah, so it's got some staying power. Yeah.
And then one that is highly relevant to the subject of this episode is a book called, and actually it's really important for my own personal research, but is a book called Indians and Colonists at the Crossroads of Empire, the Albany Congress of 1754.
I think I know who the author of that book is.
Yeah, that author is today's guest, Timothy Shannon. Although we're going to be talking about a newer work of his, Indians and Colonists at the Crossroads of Empire is still one that's pretty important for me because it shows how the Albany Congress, which is this, for those of us who are familiar with that narrative of American history, and you brought up the idea of Whig history, right? Yeah. That the Albany Congress was the first time the colonies came together and they started to form this new American identity, not just a Pennsylvania or a New York identity. Right. But the thing Shannon argues, and I think quite convincingly, is actually that's not what that meeting was about at all. Right. There's no real anticipation of future unity. It's actually just a lot of colonies who are really, really concerned about being invaded from the North by the French and their Indian allies. So they have this meeting with especially the Haudenosaunee in upstate New York, and they try to bring all of their energies together just so that they have a kind of united front.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that is not some kind of proto-national meeting there. They do want to come together, but for very different reasons, right? Mostly for protection and trade.
So how about you? Do you see any of your work in an Atlantic world context?
I don't know. I think my first book, The Way of Improvement Leads Home, my book about Philip Vickers Fithian, this ordinary farmer in New Jersey, I really place him in a kind of Enlightenment, kind of transatlantic world of ideas. The Scottish Enlightenment was deeply influential on him. You know, and part of my argument is that you could be cosmopolitan, and Tim Shannon's, we'll talk about this a little later on in the episode. You can be cosmopolitan even from a kind of local, rural, agrarian world of southern New Jersey that Fithian talked about. So, yeah, I was very deeply influenced by Atlantic history, especially as it relates to religion and ideas. My book, Was America Founded as a Christian Nation?, was really addressed to a more national audience. But as I wrote about the founders, it's hard not to talk about them in terms of the way these sort of transatlantic, at least in the British world, kind of influenced their lives. My American Bible Society book is very, I think it's very representative of what we, Tom Bender and some others, have referred to as the sort of internationalization of American history. I mean, there's chapters in that book on China, on Mexico, on, you know, so I'm thinking about this uniquely American organization, the American Bible Society, that had really impossible to understand it without its kind of global connection. So yeah, I've dabbled in it. I don't consider myself a historian of the Atlantic world like our guest today, Tim Shannon, but it's hard not to, you know, if you're a responsible early American historian, you need to be able to think about your subjects in a kind of broader context. And speaking of that, we've already mentioned our guest, but our guest today, Timothy Shannon of Gettysburg College, is one of our leading scholars and sophisticated thinkers about the Atlantic world. He's going to tell us a fascinating story about a life lived in the British Atlantic world as he introduces us to Peter Williamson, a transatlantic traveler who was called at the end of his life an Indian king. So I don't want to give too much away, but this is a very interesting new book that Shannon has out. So I'm looking forward to this interview, and I hope you enjoy it. Drew, we've had a really great season here, season 4 on The Way of Improving Leads Home. Still have a few more episodes to go, but we can always, of course, continue. We continue to need your support. We could use your support in a variety of different ways. So, Drew, tell our listeners how they can connect with us.
The Way of Improvement Leads Home is a proud member of the Recorded History Podcast Network. Head to recordedhistory.net to check out some of our fellow network podcasts. I think, especially this week, what better time than now to highlight the Explorers podcast, which highlights the long history of global exploration. Check them out at explorerspodcast.com. Our podcast is brought to you through the generous donations of Lisa DeGuardi, Ron Schooler, Kate Logan, and Gretchen Adams. And as always, many thanks to Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. If you want to become a sponsor of the show, please head over to thewayofimprovement.com and click support. And the best way to spread the word about the podcast is to take it to social media. Follow us at TWOILH Podcast on Twitter and Facebook, and consider giving us a positive review on iTunes or Stitcher. We'll be talking with Timothy Shannon in a few minutes, but first, you have your own story of a life lived in the 18th century Atlantic world, John.
It's that time of year for college professors. Time to select textbooks for the fall semester. This fall, I am once again teaching my course on colonial America at Messiah College, and once again, I will be assigning The Infortunate, The Voyage and Adventures of William Morley, an Indentured Servant. I like Morley's 18th century account of life in the British Atlantic world because this indentured servant is, in many ways, the anti-Ben Franklin. As Morley's 20th century editors Susan Klepp and Billy Smith write, 18th century America has been called the Age of Ben Franklin, an era best characterized by the values expressed in his autobiography and by his incredibly successful career. Yet Franklin was only one of several million inhabitants of the North American colonies, and by his own account, he was both exceptionally hardworking and unusually fortunate. William Morley, on the other hand, did not have such luck. He arrived at roughly the same time as Franklin, but he did not, quote-unquote, make it in America. In fact, he ended up going back home, largely a failure. Though not every arrival to the British American shores returned to Europe, very few ended up like Ben Franklin. Morley's story makes us rethink the possibility of the American dream in the colonial period and reveals how one man navigated the Atlantic world. When Morley's father died in England, he left no money to his son. When his mother remarried, Morley was left in the lurch. Flat broke and searching for a lucky break, he came to Philadelphia as an indentured servant on December 26, 1729. Upon arrival, he sold his coat for a quart of rum and his tie for sixpence and used the money to buy some bread and a quart of cider. He was eventually sold to a clockmaker and goldsmith in Burlington, New Jersey on a 4-year indenture. Morley found a boat to ferry him across the Delaware River to Burlington. He got drunk on the trip, claiming that this was the first time he had, quote unquote, experienced the strength of rum. It did not take long before Morley grew tired of his work in Burlington. He quarreled with his master and eventually tried to escape. He didn't get far. Morley was caught and placed in prison until he promised to finish the term of his indenture. Ben Franklin, he was not. In the last year of his indenture, Morley was sent to labor at an ironworks in Mount Holly, New Jersey. "Here," he wrote, "I had many a merry day." He added, quote, "Sometimes I acted the blacksmith. At other times I have worked in the water, stark naked among water snakes. Sometimes I was a cow hunter in the woods. And sometimes I got drunk for joy that my work was ended," unquote. After Morley's indenture was complete, he was set free to pursue his own American dream. It did not go well. He could not find steady work as a clockmaker in Philadelphia. He spent weeks wandering around the Pennsylvania and New Jersey countryside, where he had run-ins with wild animals, including one particular scary encounter with a panther, and he slept in haylofts. Eventually, Morley got back on a ship and returned home in an attempt to reunite with his mother and her new family. We ambitious and self-improving Americans do not look highly on a guy who openly admitted that, quote, "I neglect to improve my talents, always preferring the present time to the future, so that all these advantages were bestowed on me to no purpose," unquote. But Morley's story was not unique. The best poor man's country in the world did not always deliver on its promises.
Our guest today is Timothy Shannon, professor of history and chair of the history department at Gettysburg College in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Professor Shannon teaches courses in early American, Native American, and British history at Gettysburg. He is the author of 7 books, including Iroquois Diplomacy on the Early American Frontier, Penguin, 2008, and Indians and Colonists at the Crossroads of Empire, the Albany Congress of 1754, Cornell, 2000. The latter of which won the Dixon Ryan Fox Prize from the New York State Historical Association and the Distinguished Book Award from the Society of Colonial Wars. Today, we will be talking to Professor Shannon about his more recent book, Indian Captive, Indian King, Peter Williamson in America and Britain, published in 2018 with Harvard University Press.
Our guest today on the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast is Professor Timothy Shannon of Gettysburg College. He's the chair of the history department there, teaches American history, and we are going to talk to him today about his fascinating new book out with Harvard University Press titled Indian Captive, Indian King, Peter Williamson in America and Britain. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Let's start with the basics here. I'm guessing most of our readers do not know who Peter Williamson is. Frankly, until I learned about your work, I didn't know who Peter Williamson was. Who is this guy? Who is Peter Williamson?
Sure. He's kind of a best-kept secret, I think, in early American history.
Yeah.
So if we're going to believe him, he is somebody who came to North America in the 1740s as a young man who was kidnapped off the streets of his native Aberdeen and sold into servitude in colonial Pennsylvania. And then he had this kind of picaresque Dickensian American odyssey where he lived as an indentured servant. He eventually acquired his freedom. He says that he married and acquired his own plantation on the Pennsylvania frontier, only then to be taken captive by Indians at the outset of the French and Indian or Seven Years' War, that he escaped his captivity and then enlisted in the British Army. He saw action in the opening years of the French and Indian War, was eventually taken prisoner by the French, and ended up on a ship that carried him back to Britain, where in the 1750s, he published a captivity narrative of his time in North America, and then made his way back to Aberdeen, was eventually arrested in Aberdeen as a charlatan, as an imposter, and exiled from the city by its magistrates, And then he spent about 10 years trying to prove his identity in a series of lawsuits against those leaders of Aberdeen. We know him today primarily because he published that narrative called French and Indian Cruelty,
right,
that went through several editions, and also because, unlike any other Indian captive that I've ever encountered in my studies of early American history, he actually gave performances in which he reenacted his captivity. And so he became something of a celebrity in Great Britain during the 1750s and 60s, eventually becoming known as an Indian king.
So how did you first discover this character in the archive? I'm a grad student thinking about my future project. How do you discover someone like this?
Yeah, Drew, it's the kind of thing where if you work in archives, you're always fortunate to trip over something, right? So it seems like the most interesting finds in the archives are often something you come across because you're looking at something else. And so the story of this book actually began almost 20 years ago when I was working at the John Carter Brown Library, a rare books library in Providence, Rhode Island. And at the time, I was just trying to collect and examine images of Native Americans from the 18th century, because I was trying to track the origins of a device called the pipe tomahawk, this combined tomahawk and smoking pipe that became popular in the 18th century fur trade. And I came across one such image, and it was simply called a Delaware Indian. And it showed this person, apparently a Delaware Indian in Native American clothing, smoking one of these pipe tomahawks. And I'd never seen this image before, which really struck me. I thought, you know, I'd been around the block. I'd seen pretty much every published image of a Native American from this era. And in tracking down that image, which it was in a English language translation of a French travel narrative of North America that was published in Dublin, Ireland in 1766. So you can imagine kind of the permutations involved here. I eventually tracked that image to Williamson's narrative. It appeared in the fourth edition of his narrative. And so in finding his narrative, again, I was kind of surprised because I thought I was already conversant in all the Indian captivity narratives of this era, which I've been studying for some time. But his captivity narrative did not have an American edition. And so this was something new under the sun for me. And in reading that narrative, I really got into his story, and I became fascinated with this question of how much of this was fact and how much of it was fiction.
Now, Tim, is the image you're talking about, that's the image on the cover of the book, right?
So, yes, that is the image on the cover of the book, and there are several variations of it that appear that are also on the inside of the book.
That's right. So we just one of the things we like to do, Tim, is kind of tweet out a picture of the book. So those of you who are on Twitter, go to Twitter, and I tweeted out a picture of me holding Tim's book. That's the picture he's talking about. So this is a project, right, obviously about this really intriguing figure that no one knew about. But you're also interested in sort of larger questions, right? You know, Williamson is a window for you into what? You know, what does he teach us about the Atlantic world, which, of course, is the focus of our episode today?
Sure. I think he can teach us quite a bit about the Atlantic world, because I think he's an example of people I like to call kind of plebeian travelers in the Atlantic world, people who end up traveling back and forth across the Atlantic, who end up seeing a big part of the world, usually because they're kind of swept into tides that are beyond their control. So in his case, it's this alleged kidnapping that brings him into the servant trade and carries him from Aberdeen, Scotland, all the way to Pennsylvania. And along the way, he's shipwrecked. He encounters all sorts of interesting experiences in North America when he's serving in the army. And then his experiences as a soldier, I think, also give us kind of what we might call the worm's eye view of this major conflict in not only North American history, but in Atlantic world history. The Seven Years' War is a big deal. You know, as we know, it kind of reshapes the continent of North America. And so Williamson is giving us that worm's eye view. I think there's oftentimes this view that people like him are victims of empire. They are the cannon fodder for the British Army, right? They are people who end up doing the back-breaking labor of colonialism. They are the victims of Indian captivities and hostilities with Native peoples because they live on the frontier. But I think what's instructive about Williamson is he's showing us plebeian agency in all of this, right? Yeah, he's somebody who's making the empire his own, and he's certainly taking advantage of his experiences in it. And I was most interested in how he was kind of repackaging those images to tell his story when he returned to Britain.
Yeah, so this is a story not only of his life, right, but it's a story of some larger questions, but it's also a story of kind of print culture, and there's so many things going on here. Your book and everybody who blurbs it and you know, everything I hear about it is just sort of masterful in terms of its historical detective work. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about kind of how you took this narrative. I even noticed the way you've been speaking today, right? Williamson claims this happened to him.
Yes.
And what's fascinating about it is, you know, some of it's true, some of it's not. And you've done this kind of detective work. So let's just take one example. Let's take, you know, the captivity story, which is kind of, you know, a significant chunk of the narrative, right? What made you question the captivity narrative? And then how'd you, I think you call it at one point, a bald-faced lie, right? Walk us through this, just one example of you, the historian, kind of doing this kind of investigative kind of work to prove whether or not this kind of stuff really happened to Williamson or not.
Sure. So, of course, this is where a lot of archival work comes in. The interesting thing about Williamson is, you know, he spends 13, 14 years in North America, but he doesn't really leave much of a footprint in the archives. Yeah. And so I think as historians, we can't really hold that against him because he's a fairly small, anonymous, insignificant figure. He doesn't hold office. He doesn't own property, that sort of thing. So he's not likely to get his name recorded in different places.
Right,
but
right.
The thing that struck me about his captivity narrative when I read it for the first time was that it didn't pass my sniff test.
Yeah.
I was very familiar with other captivity stories from Pennsylvania during the era of the French and Indian War. And while many of the details in his narrative had a kind of an element of truth to them, for example, he appeared to be very familiar with the geography of frontier Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
There were elements to the story that did not ring true, such as he claims that he was taken captive in October of 1754, and he made his way home in January of 1755, basically a three-month captivity.
Right.
And that is exactly 1 year too early for the captivities that occur in Pennsylvania at the start of the French and Indian War, because the Indians begin raiding the frontier after the defeat of Braddock's army at the Monongahela in the summer of 1755. And so that didn't smell right. And then there were elements, too, when he describes some of the tortures that he witnesses other captives enduring that were not consistent with what we know about how Native Americans dealt with captives during this era. The lack of evidence to corroborate his story was striking because he claimed that when he returned to the East, when he returned to where he had been taken from, that he went to Philadelphia and actually had an interview with the governor of Pennsylvania at the time and gave testimony before the Pennsylvania Assembly. And none of that is recorded in the records of those offices. So in that case, the lack of evidence seemed pretty damning for him. It raised this very interesting question then of, you know, well, why fabricate a captivity?
Right.
And that, again, becomes a very interesting component of the story because other elements of his American Odyssey definitely pan out. He was shipwrecked off the coast of Cape May. He was, in fact, purchased by a fellow Scotsman as an indentured servant. And his time in the military, what he describes about that, is corroborated by a lot of other evidence, yet he chooses to make this fictional captivity narrative the centerpiece of his story when he returns home.
And why does he do that?
I think he's doing that because he's giving the people what they want. You know, he's part of this first wave of British soldiers to return to Great Britain at the outset of the French Indian War. Braddock's army is defeated in July of 1755, but in that defeat, it's also dispersed. And so there are no veterans or prisoners of war returning to Britain from that experience to tell their tale.
Right.
Williamson is taken at the fall of Oswego in August of 1756. He's part of a group of 1,100 prisoners of war who are repatriated to Britain. And so he's part of this first tide, this first vanguard of eyewitnesses to come back and tell their stories in Britain. And I think he realizes that the public's appetite has been whetted for stories about Native Americans because of these two dramatic defeats of the British Army on the North American frontier. So as he's making his way back to Aberdeen, the way he's going to distinguish himself from other returning veteran soldiers who've been cut adrift is he can tell a story about Indian captivity.
How much is this kind of, part of his kind of commercial or his economic, he's going around, telling the story. He's dressing up like an Indian. I mean, he needs this background, right, to sustain himself in this.
Yes. And he's part, in that sense, he's also part of this plebeian tradition in Britain at this time of what I describe as disguise and impersonation.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, poor people, laboring people who are stuck in a bad situation. It might be a woman in a bad marriage. It might be a man who has a bad boss or master. They'll use disguise as a way of gaining mobility. So, we hear these stories about women who disguise themselves as men to join the army and leave home that way.
Yeah.
And Williamson at the time, when he returns to Aberdeen, he's described as a stroller, which today we might translate as a confidence man, somebody who's kind of on the move and is taking advantage of people's gullibility to defraud them, to extract alms from them and that sort of thing. And I think his kind of commercial entrepreneurial orientation reflects that background and that willingness to use dissembling, to use impersonation and disguise as a way of kind of making your way forward in the world.
Yeah, real quick, back to the your sort of first reading of this captivity narrative. Mm-hmm. Did a red flag go off immediately, or first time you read it, it seems like this can't be right. What was the relationship between you obviously being a very experienced historian looking at this stuff for the first time, right? In a way, maybe a grad student wouldn't pick up. Sorry, Drew. But to what extent was it kind of, I've been doing this for a long time, this isn't right, versus kind of, okay, this doesn't seem right, and then kind of like a domino effect, right? You start doing research and, oh my gosh, now I don't trust anything. Tell us how you kind of navigated that whole thing.
Sure. It was more of the latter. It was a gradual kind of disenchantment that I was having with his story. One of the first things I did after reading his narrative was I began asking around to other historians of this era saying, hey, have you read this narrative? Yeah. Do you know anything about it? And very few of my colleagues in North America did know about it. And the few that did kind of shrugged it off and said, it's a fabrication. Don't take it seriously. But there was so much else in the narrative, particularly the story of his kidnapping, and then all this time that he spends in the army, that struck me as worth investigating, because even if you extracted the captivity narrative from the tale, there was still these elements of kind of, was he really shipwrecked? Was he really kidnapped? And in pursuing those questions, that's when I figured out that there was really so much here to unpack, because initially when I started working on him, I thought, oh, I'll get a good article out of this. This is an interesting story to tell. But when I began investigating his kidnapping, I found out that in the National Archives of Scotland, there are these voluminous files on his two lawsuits in which he was attempting to prove his identity and to sue the magistrates who had exiled him from the city, and ultimately to sue the merchants who had invested in the voyage that brought him to North America. And reading those affidavits and depositions really helped me unpack the story of his life before his alleged Indian captivity.
Yeah, and it seems like those really kind of made it a book project, right? The availability of those.
Yes. And there was a lot of time spent in Edinburgh, in the National Archives of Scotland, in the National Library of Scotland, going over those materials.
Now, so what I'm hearing, if I understand you correctly, I was initially going to ask you, have there been other historians who have taken this work at face value, right? But
yes.
now I'm thinking I may ask you a sort of different question, because I get the sense that like most of the historians immediately dismiss this thing. And you are saying, well, yes, but there actually is some truth to some of his accounts too. You know, could you talk about that? I mean, have there been other historians who have just simply used him as a primary source without sort of debunking anything?
Go ahead. Okay. And there's a real divide here between historians in Britain, particularly Scotland, who have been familiar with him for a long time, and historians in North America who have been less familiar with him. So historians in North America who have used him have usually studied him in the context of the servant trade of the 18th century, because his is probably the best documented case of a kidnapping into servitude in the 18th century. So his narrative does pop up in the footnotes of people who are writing about the kidnapping of children into servitude. The people who've studied who've studied Indian captivity in North America generally have ignored him. His narrative eventually finds its way into print in North America in the late 1790s and the early 19th century. It's often included in compendiums of captivity tales from that era. But it never makes its way into what we might call the canon of American literature when it comes to captivity stories. He's not as famous as, you know, Daniel Boone or Mary Rowlandson or Mary Jameson, folks like that. In Scotland, the story is different because his story remains in print for a long time in Scotland. After his death, it's republished as kind of a children's adventure tale. It's actually picked up by abolitionists who publish it in order to encourage sympathy for the anti-slavery cause. And the only biography that's ever been written of him, full-length biography, is by a Scottish author of true crime stories who published it in the late 20th century. And that author took Williamson at his word, and so assumed that his captivity tale was true, and didn't attempt to do any kind of archival digging on him in North America. And that's something new that I'm doing. But I did have an interesting encounter after talking about Williamson at a conference once. I had a fellow come up to me from the audience who was a native Aberdonian. And he said, you know, when I was growing up, we learned about him in grade school. You know, he was a kind of a local historical figure of note. And you can imagine how school children might be very impressed by his story.
Oh, absolutely.
And so, but again, it's usually in the context of his kidnapping and kind of anticipating what becomes the famous novel Kidnapped by Robert Louis Stevenson.
Right, right. So the title of your book, Tim, is Indian Captive, Indian King. We've spent a lot of time here talking about captivity, his so-called captivity, if you will.
Right.
Tell us about Indian King. Why is that in the title? How is Williamson, or how does he become an Indian King? What does that phrase mean?
Yes, well, it's a very interesting phrase that gets attached to him during the latter part of his life, when you know, he's returned to Great Britain and ultimately he settles in Edinburgh. And he does some interesting things as urban tradesman and entrepreneur. He basically gains control of the means of production of his celebrity. So, you know, there were other Indian captives who returned to Great Britain, you know, from time in colonial America. And usually they published their stories as these narratives as a way of kind of raising some money. But then they slipped anonymously back into life. Williamson does something that reminds me of what a sports star might do when he retires from the game. You know, he buys a bar or a restaurant so that he can continue to be a famous person in his adopted hometown. And so Williamson opens up a coffee house in Edinburgh where he displays supposed artifacts from North America. And he buys a printing press and he goes into business as a printer. And so he becomes this urban tradesmen in a city that's very famous for having its share of eccentric characters. And along the way, people begin calling him variations of this term, an Indian king. And clearly they mean it as kind of satire, as a sort of nickname. And the term has its roots in these visitations that various Indian delegations made to Great Britain, starting with Pocahontas, you know, all the way back in the early 17th century. But in the 18th century, the four Indian kings in 1710, a Cherokee delegation in 1730, another Cherokee delegation in the 1760s. And these Indian kings, you know, became objects of celebrity and celebration whenever they visited places like London. And so Williamson, when his local friends and other characters in Edinburgh begin calling him an Indian king, I think they're saying that he's somebody, they appreciate him as a teller of tall tales. Yeah. They appreciate him as a fabulist, somebody who has certainly seen a big part of the world, but who has come back to tell his tale. And we can't really entirely believe it, but it's kind of fun to believe it.
Yeah.
And so there are a couple of poets working in Edinburgh who refer to him first as an Indian king. They call him King of the Mohawk Nation because uh-huh. the Mohawks were allies of the British. And then towards the end of his life, there are people who refer to him as King of the Cherokees, because the Cherokee now have become significant in British history because of their alliance with Great Britain during the American Revolution. And Williamson, of course, invites this by continuing to tell his tale and kind of weave it in new ways that often contradict the captivity story. So in 1768, he publishes a book called The Travels of Peter Williamson, mm-hmm. which is really just a Frankenstein's monster of plagiarized passages from other travel narratives in North America. But he's kind of presenting himself in this as a gentleman traveler, you know, an Indian captive is somebody who's poor, somebody who's victimized, somebody who's on the edge of the frontier and the edge of society. But an Indian king, you know, is a cosmopolitan traveler who's gone out and lived among the Indians and traveled with them and kind of become an anthropologist, almost a participant observer. Yeah. And that's how he's cultivating that reputation as an Indian king.
So his story, as the editions go on, his story changes. It's like,
yes, it does.
To you fit know, his the, circumstances. Yeah.
Yeah. The, his captivity narrative goes through six editions in 10 years. And there are really only minor changes in the story he tells there. You know, at one point he drops the identification of himself as a disbanded soldier from the front page because I think that's not really paying off for him because disbanded soldiers are, you know, people of menace in this society.
Right.
But when he publishes The Travels of Peter Williamson, he references his captivity, but he blatantly contradicts it. You know, it makes it sound like he did not spend 3 months captive among Indians who were torturing him and beating him. No, he lived among the Indians since his infancy, he says. You know, and he traveled around the continent. He saw Niagara Falls with them. He learned about Indian medicine and that sort of thing. And so his captivity in The Travels of Peter Williamson becomes more like, you know, an apprenticeship among right. the Indians of North America.
Right, right. Well, our time is just about up here, Tim, but we always like to ask our guests, especially those who are authors, if they're working on any new and exciting projects. How about you? Are you do you have another project in the works?
Sure. Well, I'm just getting underway, I think, with what will be the next big project. And it's going to focus on Benjamin Franklin's writings about and interactions with Native Americans
oh, wow.
over the long course of his career. I've been interested in Franklin for a long time. I've worked on him in other capacities in the past, but I think he's pretty unique among, you know, the founding generation, because not only does he encounter real Indians when he's working as a treaty commissioner for the government of Pennsylvania in the 1750s. And he's as a printer, he's publishing Indian treaties in the 1740s, 1750s. But he also writes about Indians quite a bit. Even when he's living in London and in Paris, he's using Indians as allegories or as foils when he's writing editorials in Britain, for example, on behalf of the Patriot cause. And so I think by unpacking what Franklin has to say about Indians over the long course of his life, we can begin to kind of trace some of the intellectual heritage and development of these various ideas about Native Americans, where they come from, what the nature of their society is like, and what place they're going to occupy in the new nation. So we're just getting started with that, John, but I think that will be the next big one.
Yeah, well, we'll be looking for that, definitely, and try to catch you kind of out there on the conference circuit trying to try your stuff out, right?
Sure, sure.
Well, our guest today has been Timothy Shannon. He is the author of Indian Captive, Indian King, Peter Williamson in America and Britain, Harvard University Press 2018. Go get it, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookstores and everything. It's a fascinating read and a wonderful example of how a historian works. with the detective work and the investigative research and so forth. Tim, thanks so much for taking some time out of your day and joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on the program, John and Drew.
All right. Have a great day. So, Drew, we had maybe one of our first serious Native American historians on the program today, right? What is your reaction?
It felt good. It felt like I finally felt like I could keep up.
Yeah, Shannon is just a prolific author, and all of his stuff is just so, so good. I really appreciate the way, too, he writes monographs, but he also writes textbooks. He's written textbooks on the Atlantic world and colonial America, all from a sort of liberal arts institution, right, at Gettysburg College. And I've known him to be a very sort of gifted public speaker and communicator of history as well.
Yeah, I'm also especially struck by this kind of mode of telling the Atlantic story. You know, he kept using that word, worm's eye view, term worm's eye view. And I kept thinking about, as he was talking about this very curious individual who tells this very unique story, I kept thinking about Esther Wheelwright in our episode with Ann Little.
It's yeah.
another way to get a worm's eye view into Atlantic history. So I'm really, and part of it's because I, you know, as I envision my future project, my future dissertation project, I like this idea of the worm's eye view as an approach to talking about empire in North America, especially.
Yeah. I love those kind of books. I love obviously Ann Little's book. I love this book. You know, also it's this kind of history is near and dear to my heart. You know, Philip Vickers Fithian didn't have the sort of transatlantic experience or even the transnational experience that someone like Wheelwright did, going back and forth between Canada and the colonies, or obviously didn't have the experience of a Williamson. But, you know, this idea of kind of connecting these larger Atlantic patterns, these macro storylines with flesh and blood, right? Real life. A real individual. Those books, I just eat up. You know, I look for any opportunity to read, and this is a real page turner. You know, especially we didn't get a chance to talk about the trial where he tried to prove that he was kidnapped. You know, the way he constructs himself as an Indian king, but also early in his life, there's a lot of stuff in here about the Enlightenment, coffee house culture in Edinburgh. Consumerism. Again, Shannon is one of our best kind of chroniclers of the Atlantic world in this way. A lot of the Atlantic world literature historians, right, they write in such macro ways,
right?
This, you know, they're flying at 30,000 feet and you don't really get the true stories. And it's not their fault. There's just not a lot of kind of stories. You know, even Shannon said, right, he started this as just an article, and then, you know, he found these trial transcripts in the archives in Scotland, and it just turned into a really great kind of, I don't know if he called it a micro history or a biography or Well, I hope you enjoyed our episode today. I know we certainly did, talking with Timothy Shannon about Peter Williamson. Thanks for listening. And as always, may your way of improvement lead home.
This has been a production of The Way of Improvement Leads Home, a blog dedicated to reflections at the intersection of American history, religion, politics, and academic life. Visit us at thewayofimprovement.com. The Way of Improvement Leads Home is a member of the Recorded History Podcast Network. Check out the other podcasts on the network by heading over to recordedhistory.net. If you want to support our efforts, please rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice so others may more easily find this podcast. And let's continue the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us at TWOILH Podcast. The podcast was brought to you through the generous support of Gretchen Adams, Kate Logan, Lisa DeGuardi, and Ron Schooler. Also, many thanks to our sponsor, Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. The podcast was recorded at the High Center Studios of Messiah College. Thanks to Ed Ark for his continued support. Original music is by Overholt. Many thanks to our guest, Timothy Shannon. Our studio producer is Josh Lowry. I've been your producer, Drew Durley Hermeling, and your host, as always, is John Fia. Mm-hmm.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.